Welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. Charles Cullen is a serial killer who was in jail from murdering and admitting to murdering 40 patients, but the number may be much greater than that. His story is detailed in the new book, The Good Nurse, A True Story of Medicine, Madness, and Murders, published by Charles Graber. Authored by Charles Graber and published by 12 Book, a division of Hachette Publications. Today we are talking with the author, journalist, award-winning journalist, Charles Graber, and with a nurse attorney, Edie Brouse, in what is part two of this two-part program on what happened to Charles Cullen, what his story is, and more so, what is the culpability of the hospitals at which he worked and at which he murdered patients, and that these hospitals subsequently terminated him without reporting him to the proper authorities in a timely fashion. And so I want to thank Charles Graber for returning to Health Styles to talk with us some more about this story. Thank you, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
And also to Edie Brouse. She is a nurse attorney in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York, where she represents nurses who are reported for misconduct, but Edie, not usually for serial murders, right?
Not that often in my practice, no.
Fortunately. Right.
I'm trying
right.
to think if I've ever represented anyone who's been accused of
murder.
And I have to say no, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. And she's also former president of the American Association of Nurse Attorneys. And for those of you who may not have heard part one, Charles Cullen was a registered nurse who, between 1987 and 2003, murdered what, Charles Graber, you have estimated to be possibly 300 murders or
right,
more.
Right, the experts I've spoken to think it's probably above 300.
And he did so by giving overdoses of medications that usually are used to treat certain conditions when given in a normal dose or under specific circumstances. And so he went on the last program, we were chronicling how he went from hospital to hospital doing this, and as evidence mounted that there was something going on, that there were too many deaths and that under suspicious conditions, and people were making linkages that hospitals kept passing him on to other hospitals. That's probably not the right way to say it. Hospitals let him go without reporting him to the State Board for Nursing or reporting him to the police. And so we were last talking about he had worked at St. Luke's, where a nurse, Pat Medlin, had actually pieced together that it was some data linking when Charles Cullen was working and when patients were dying. And she took that to the administration and was told the investigation was closed. And she actually told me that she felt harassed by the hospital, was queried for over 6 hours in a two-week period, and was thought by the hospital to have been collecting information on behalf of families who the hospital probably was worried would sue the hospital. So they pieced together, let's pick that up at St. Luke's, they pieced together that Cullen is
right. Some, yeah.
suspicious, but it's even a little bit more than suspicious,
yeah, they,
isn't it?
Yeah, what had happened is that they noticed that during one of the night shifts, a nurse had tried to throw something and put something in the sharps bin and noticed that she couldn't even get it in there, and looked and it was full. And it was full of a few different types of things. Unused medications that had just been thrown away out of spite, it turns out. And used medications that had not been prescribed, including deadly drugs, including vecuronium, a paralytic. Lawyers were brought in the next night, actually not that night, so another shift went on. And it was it had happened again, and he was caught red-handed again at that same point. He was being observed.
Cullen was caught red-handed,
and was at the very least allowed to resign that same evening, and was provided with neutral references going forward. We learn later that while the police were not contacted by the administration, other hospitals in the area were contacted informally. The St. Luke's maintains that that was that they were conducting their own investigation into Cullen's past for whatever reason. But in the course of all those conversations, they did also pass on the information that Cullen was not eligible for rehire at St. Luke's. They did not give neutral references during those conversations, I guess you could say. Subsequently, Cullen moved on to another hospital, Somerset Medical Center in Somerville, New Jersey, and where he killed a great many more patients. And after his arrest and confession, there were a great many civil suits brought by family members against these against hospitals, and Somerset Medical Center sued St. Luke's Medical Center, St. Luke's Hospital, and St. Luke's tried to have that thrown out. And the judge, the ruling of the court, Judge Garrido. I'm paraphrasing here; it's off the top of my head, but essentially ruled that that in deciding to call some hospitals and give them warning and not others, effectively St. Luke's had decided who would live and who would die, and that really is the crux of when you talk about responsibility. At what point would a reasonable person have suspicion that Cullen may have harmed patients? At what point would it be their responsibility to not circle the wagons and not keep this internal institutionally, but to in fact involve authorities? And at what point can you even make this public? Because I know that I'm not a policy person. I know this is your field, and it'd be interesting to know. It seems quite obvious in retrospect that absolutely that more should have been done. But what's the peril there? Is there a risk in doing that?
Of course there is, but there's risk in not doing it as well. And you do this whole cost benefit analysis of which risk you're going to take, and you may make the decision based on which suit you think you can win, or you can make the decision based on what's the right thing to do here. Because in my experience, even if you do the wrong thing, if you're doing it for the right reason, even if you're being sued for doing something, but you can justify your decisions. You can say the reason you did this was, you have a rationale for it. And that rationale, at the heart of that rationale is patient safety. So that's why we did this. We can defend you. If you're doing something because it'll generate revenue, it'll save us financial loss, it'll help our reputation, or any of those other reasons, but it pays it, puts patients at risk in the process, that's pretty hard to justify. And I understand concerns about patient privacy, concerns about HIPAA, concerns about state privacy law. I understand that. But safety trumps privacy. And if that's your concern, you're concerned about patient safety or you're concerned about patient privacy, you're making a choice. And you're saying that patient privacy is more important than patient safety. And if I were trying to defend somebody, I would rather defend somebody who violated privacy but saved lives than someone who protected privacy at the expense of patients dying. Mm. So it's a cost-benefit analysis, but it's also what's just the right thing to do here. Mm. So you have an employee that you are really concerned about, you think is unsafe in their practice, whether you think they're purposefully, intentionally killing patients or not, if you think they're unsafe in their practice, you have an obligation as an organization to report that to the nursing board. And you have an obligation to forget the neutral references. And I know that I've helped negotiate for neutral references on people who have been terminated or offered the option to resign in lieu of termination, but not when they're really unsafe, not when they're dangerous. Then you don't give neutral references. There are many organizations that have as their policy, it's a human resources policy, that they only give neutral references ever.
And a neutral reference would say, this person worked here from date to that date in this capacity,
That's right.
period.
You confirm employment dates, you confirm the title or the role that they were in, you may confirm their salary, and that's it. And that's all you say. And supposedly, the neutral reference, that only confirming dates of employment, salary, and the position they were in, protects you from either side. So if you don't say something untoward about a person, and they go out and hurt somebody in another facility, that facility can't hold you responsible because you didn't say anything good about them. If you don't say anything bad about them, you're protected from suits of defamation or interference with contract or anything else. So With Colin, you want to be neutral, because if you say, we think he's a shady character, we think he's creepy, we think he's got some mental health issues, he may be very dangerous, he can sue you for defamation, he can sue you for all these other things, and it will interfere with his ability to get a job somewhere else, and he may be able to sue you for that. If you say, we think he's a good nurse, we think he is safe in patient care, we think whatever, and he goes out there and hurts somebody, then that organization, like Somerset, can hold you responsible if you do that. So you just cut it down the middle, and you supposedly cut your losses on both sides by only giving neutral references.
But Edie Brouse, there is, I thought there was an obligation on the part of hospitals to report employees who really are incompetent or unsafe. Now, that doesn't mean if I've made a mistake as a nurse that I'm reported to the state board necessarily. We know that some errors happen because systems aren't what they need to be in hospitals. They're not the way they are in airplanes, where there are redundancy of systems that catch errors,
right,
so that I, as a human, I'm going to make a mistake. That doesn't mean I'm incompetent. It doesn't mean I'm intentionally doing something. But when there is a nurse who we believe is incompetent or is intentionally harming patients, is there not an obligation to report to the State Board for Nursing?
Of course there is. You have to report it to the Board of Nursing if you have taken disciplinary action against someone because they're incompetent, because they're unsafe, because they're impaired in their practice, because they're doing a lot of other things. And the state's Administrative Procedure Acts, or the Nurse Practice Acts, or the health laws, or the general business laws, or all of the above, say that. And in fact, in both New Jersey and in Pennsylvania, the Nurse Practice Act say not only do employers have this responsibility, but so do colleagues and coworkers. And in fact, that's true in most states. You have an obligation as a licensed professional to report impaired colleagues or unsafe colleagues. The problem is that in my experience, and I look at things through a defense lens, so it's a little biased in that sense. You know, I'll give you that disclaimer. Employers are too quick to do it in the opposite direction, where you have nurses who make unintentional and inevitable human error, because we don't have the redundancies and the people proofing in our systems, because we are a high-risk industry that doesn't treat healthcare as high-risk activity. You have nurses, and especially with medications, who are in very dangerous systems. We're still relying on 20th century technology, sometimes 19th century technology. We don't have the technology, even though it's available, we're not using it to inform practice and to keep patients safe. We're expecting perfection in practice as a mechanism to keep patients safe. We're expecting nurses who are understaffed, mm-hmm, who have got patient loads that are insane right now with the level of acuity we've got, in, especially in hospital settings, to be able to continue taking care of patients without all of the safety mechanisms in place that they need to be safe.
Yeah.
And then we hold them responsible when something goes wrong. You know, we're telling these nurses that we expect them to knit with one needle, and then we're punishing them for the quality of their stitches. Mm-hmm. And when they make an unintentional human error, we crucify them.
Yeah.
We fire them. We report them to the board. We need to make the distinction between intentional misconduct and unintentional human error, especially nurses working in dangerous systems.
There's a huge disconnect here when I hear this story. Hospitals that not only didn't report but actually covered up. You chronicle, Charles Graber, in the Good Nurse, you chronicle the fact that when detectives came to, I believe it was Somerset Medical Center, and asked to see records of medication given, etc., they were not forthcoming with the information.
Right. They were told they didn't. Well, initially they didn't even know what Pyxis was. The detectives.
And what is Pyxis?
And Pyxis is, I'm going to, you correct me.
But yeah, go ahead.
Because I explain it on different levels and usually not the technical one. But Pyxis is essentially an accounting system for medications that nurses order, that patients receive. And it's a way to not only keep track of who's given what and who's ordered what, but it's also a way of tracking the billing and tracking the restocking. And essentially the Pyxis machine, which is made by an outfit called Cardinal Health, looks like it's like a cash register with a computer on it. I guess it's a modern cash register with drawers that pop open, and the different drawers contain the different medications.
So you can really track who gave what and who ordered what and who ordered new supplies.
Right. You'd have to, you know, a nurse would have to log in his or her name and the patient number.
And you can timestamp every keystroke.
Yes. Right. So the risk manager told the detectives initially that the Pyxis records only went back for a month.
Right. Or
30 days.
Yeah. And the last victim that they were looking at, the last potential victim, because they couldn't even prove necessarily that it was a victim. In fact, the detectives weren't sure exactly what they were being called in for, but the death of that last victim had been more than 30 days previous.
And yet later, the detectives find out that, no, those records are there.
Right. They were getting frustrated with the hospital. They felt that maybe the hospital was not... They were not getting all the information they wanted, and they went ahead and called Cardinal Health and were told, no, of course the machine stores all the data indefinitely. Is there asked if there is some sort of a problem with the machine, and they were not happy with the hospital at all when they heard that.
So this was stunning to me, because here it's not just the hospital is keeping its mouth shut about this nurse in terms of referrals or recommendations to other facilities. They're actively impeding an investigation. These are police detectives, correct?
Right. Oh, right. These are homicide detectives, former Newark homicide detectives. Very, you know, big city, lots of murders, decorated, seasoned homicide detectives dealing with medical murder. Basically, counting on the hospital. They're used to coming from Newark. Everything pretty much involved. It started with drugs and ended with a gun.
Yeah.
This was something. This was Greek to them, literally. Mm-hmm. That's the way they described it. Mm-hmm. They didn't understand the names. They didn't understand the processes. They weren't necessarily being told that it was homicide. They had no idea where to start. So they were dependent upon the hospital to be their guide.
We're talking today with Charles Graber, who's the author of the new book, The Good Nurse, A True Story of Medicine, Madness, and Murders, that chronicles the story of Charles Cullen and includes the culpability of all these hospitals he worked at while he was killing patients. And it's a really stunning book, a very disturbing book, Charles. You sort of wonder how people will feel when they have to go to a hospital these days. And we're also talking with Edie Brouse, a former president of the American Association of Nurse Attorney, and a nurse attorney who represents nurses who are brought up on charges of misconduct in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York. And Edie, I wanted to go back to you and ask you whether you have been practicing in New Jersey for how long? Since when?
Since 2001.
So in 2004, the state passed the Patient Safety Act and then this Enhancement Act that give hospitals actually some protection if they do report, but also requires them to report, although we're not sure about what penalties there are built in. We can't find the penalties at this point for if they don't report. So reporting to the State Department of Health and also reporting to the State Board for Nursing, any disciplinary action against nurses. Have you seen any change in what hospitals are doing since those acts were passed?
I think the situation of hospitals taking disciplinary action against nurses and reporting them to the nursing board for misconduct has escalated. That's gotten much, much worse. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is that we've initiated tort reform in a lot of jurisdictions. And so if patients are angry and they think that we have harmed them and they want to hold us accountable, but our legislatures have made it difficult for them to sue us, they've created more procedural hurdles or more hoops for them to jump through, or they've capped damages or whatever, then the only recourse they have is to complain to licensing boards. So that's one reason that complaints to boards have gone up. But another is the economy.
Yeah.
In a good market, employers will work with nurses that have some baggage. I may be on probation with my nursing board and require quarterly reports from my employer or monitoring or some practice restrictions or whatever. And in a good economy, when we're desperately short of nurses, my boss will work with me on this.
Yeah.
In this market, for every nurse who's employed, there are 3, 4, or 5 out there who want that job. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to hire someone or keep someone on staff with baggage, especially an experienced nurse, because I'm paying that differential to them. I'd rather have somebody right out of the starting gate, because they're less expensive. And you have a lot of nurses now who normally would have retired,
yes,
but can't afford to, because their pensions were destroyed a few years ago, or because their partner has lost their job and they're the sole breadwinner. You have a lot of nurses who would be per diem or part-time that are full-time. So you have this artificial supply of nurses right now because of the economy, and that makes employers behave even more badly.
And we might point out that between 87 and 2003, there was a severe, in the 90s, severe nursing shortage, and hospitals were taking what we called any warm body. And there was great concern about the quality of some of the nurses that were being hired. And so for people who ask, well, why were they hiring this guy that they couldn't get a good reference on? He was a body. He was a warm body.
And he got hiring bonuses over and over again. I mean, he made a lot in bonuses in order to cross state lines time and time again. They were bounties.
Yeah, yeah. So Cullen finally gets nabbed, and it is. I want to point out that there were. The title of your book has some irony to it. It's called The Good Nurse because here's Cullen, who some people think is a good nurse. And
sometimes he was.
Yes, and he certainly thought he was a good nurse.
Yes,
right?
It was very important to him.
Right. And yet there were good nurses in this story who, like Pat Medlin, who pieced together the story and put her own job on the line to try to bring it to the attention of first her administration when they wouldn't listen, to take it to the police. And
right.
She essentially got run out of the state for doing that.
Right.
And then there's the story of Amy McLaughlin.
Yeah,
Amy Loughran.
Yeah, who's now named Ridgway. I maintained her maiden name so that she could choose whether she was going to come out with that or not, and she has. So
okay.
I can say that. So Amy Ridgway.
And she wore what? She was Cullen's friend.
She was his biggest defender.
Yeah.
They worked, as she put it later, that we wrapped a lot of bodies together. And she was a tough woman that looked up to Charlie, her friend Charlie, as a peer and a mentor and a confidant. And they worked the overnights. He also covered for her because she had a heart condition. So she felt very guilty later when she wondered whether or not he'd been in covering for her. She was somehow complicit in murder. But when detectives came around, when there was the first inklings that there might be trouble there, she was his biggest defender. She, as a survivor, as a tough person, actually shielded him from criticism. In fact, in one case, she found him injecting a patient with lidocaine who was allergic to lidocaine, and they both knew that, and it wouldn't have been his first choice in medications anyway, and she actually took responsibility for it. She said it was her, went to the resident. I mean, there was, so she went that far. And she was also very defensive in the police were, the detectives, Danny Baldwin and Tim Braun, were trying to interview all the nurses, and the risk manager was always present. That was one of the conditions, and they were not having a lot of luck. And Amy didn't want to be. In fact, she started calling in sick when her interview days were coming up. She just refused to speak to these guys. And then she did, and Amy and the risk manager happened to leave the room for a bathroom break, and one of the detectives showed her one of the Pyxis pages they'd gotten, and she knew right away that. Well, she knew maybe she was defending the wrong guy, and from that point. In fact, that's when she said to detectives, "We've wrapped a lot of bodies together," and they visited her that night, and during that visit, in her home, which is several hours away, because she was another transfer nurse, she ended up wearing a wire and being an integral part and actually getting Cullen her best friend to confess. She had to turn against everyone at great risk.
So he's now in jail where?
He's in Trenton, maximum security. He's in non-com. He spends, he's not in the general population because he'd be a target. He spends 23 hours a day in a cell.
So, Charles Graber, why'd you do this book?
Well, I didn't think it was going to take 7 years when I started. I'll admit that.
Yeah.
But it really was a mission, and I'm really pleased that I did. It was, at first, I became involved because I was interested in Cullen and he was willing to speak with me. But once I scratched the surface, I discovered a much more complicated story than a monster who got caught by the institutions that were supposed to catch him. And it was a story that no one knew. Everyone thought maybe this was a mercy killing, or you know, they called him the Angel of Death, suggesting there was some element of mercy, and that was the point. And certainly, no one was speaking at length about the what the hospitals had done or not done. It was a story that required a book, and required a lot of research. And so that was the mission.
And what would you like to come out of this?
I would like people to actually be able to discuss, to know what happened. I think that's what it took a long time, not just to gather all the facts, but to put the facts together in a way that everyone, you know, nurses, laymen, people that just, you know, just want to read. I believe in accidental education.
Yeah.
And it took even longer to make this a story that everyone could read through and understand because they're medical terms.
Yeah.
So that's why I'd like the public, the readership, to be able to be on the same page so that we can actually have a conversation about what's next.
And I think what's next is a really important point. I want to just, to, as we wrap here because we're out of time, just point out that it is a fabulous read. I mean, it is gripping read.
It's a page turner.
It absolutely is. Yeah.
I read it in a few hours. Started it and wouldn't stop till I was done.
Yes. So, and I think it's incumbent upon all of us to keep the conversation going about holding these healthcare organizations accountable for putting the safety of patients before their reputations, because it's my conclusion, and you made this conclusion, Edie, in the first part of this interview, that part one, that they were more interested in reducing their exposure for liability purposes and payouts that they might have to make from families suing, in trying to steal up their reputation in their communities and trying to protect donations to their institutions. And certainly all of us want to know that when we go to a hospital, they're going to put our interests first. So I want to thank you, Charles Graber, for taking the time to do this book. It's a fascinating book, and for coming on Health Styles today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Diana.
And I want to thank you, Edie Brouse, for coming on and sharing us your insights as a nurse attorney.
Thank you.
So we've been talking with Charles Graber, an award-winning journalist and the author of The Good Nurse, A True Story of Medicine, Madness, and Murder, that you can get at Amazon.com or all kinds of bookstores. It's a top bestseller these days, as well as Edie Brouse, former president of the American Association of Nurse Attorneys and a practicing attorney in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York. I'm Diana Mason. Thank you for listening to Health Styles. It's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com.